Hello, hello. Welcome to this edition of Spill the Wine. I am Christoph Ellinghaus, and today I'm talking with Jonathan Taplin, who wrote a great book called Move Fast and Break Things, subtitled How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. That is one hell of a long book title, but there is a lot to say here. Not only that, the man who wrote it is a most interesting character. In every decade, he did something really significant. So this is really fascinating. In the 60s, he was the tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band when Dylan made the public transition from acoustic folky to amplified rock and roller. You know, hashtag Judas and all that. In the 70s, he then somehow ended up producing movies, among them Martin Scorsese's debut film Mean Streets, which is widely considered to be one of the kickstarters of the so-called New Hollywood era. Appropriately, in the 80s, the decade of greed and neoliberalism and deregulation, the man worked as an investment banker. You know, the proper 80s stuff. In the 90s, he started a video on demand service on the internet, which is, you know, kind of visionary when we were all still dialing up with an analog modem. So obviously that tanked. But then he moved into academia and spent a couple of decades on technical innovation, studying all of that stuff. And then ultimately he wrote this book, which we're discussing today. And he is now the director emeritus of the Annenberg Innovation Lab at the University of Southern California. So he's retired. He wrote this book. And so there are many good reasons to ask him for a chat on this podcast. Now, the title of this book, Move Fast and Break Things, that is one of those early days Mark Zuckerberg catchphrases, you know, just like the Google had a slogan early called Don't Be Evil, which I think they changed to Do the Right Thing. Oh my God. Anyways, so move fast and break things. It kind of says it all, right? This whole, we move fast, we disrupt, we are hackers, we innovate. If you stand in our way, we will probably break things. So better get with the program. Obviously, those things that break are seen as just collateral damage. Now, in this book, Jonathan Taplin points out that the things at stake here are not exactly small. The four pillars of democracy are at stake and under attack from big tech. This book talks all about that and a lot more. It's one of the best books I have read last year. So let's talk to its author, Jonathan Taplin. Unfortunately, via the old Skype, as our face-to-face interview late last year had fallen through. So here we are, Jonathan Taplin and me talking about the internet via the internet. Thank you for coming on my podcast.
My pleasure.
I would like to ask a bit about your backstory first. I read through your book, Move Fast and Break Things, and I found that you happened to be in all these pivotal historical moments. For instance, you were tour managing the band when Bob Dylan went electric, correct?
Yes.
Did you have any sense that history was being made right there and then?
Yeah, I mean, the sequence is slightly different. Bob went electric before he met up with the band. He went electric at the Newport Folk Festival in July of 1965. I think I had a sense that something really important was happening. And yet it was surprising to see the reaction from the folk music fans, the negative reaction to his playing rock and roll on the stage. And, you know, that was something that actually continued for many, many months. By the fall of 65, he had met up with the band and they were called the Hawks and they became his backup band. And the negative reaction to the rock and roll portion of the show continued all around the world. I mean, not just in the United States, but in Europe and Australia and everywhere. So it was kind of surprising.
Wow.
Because quite honestly, the music that was being made was extraordinary.
Right. But it was changed. There was something that people weren't ready for. I mean, you know, the human nature is not so keen on change, I suppose.
Yes.
And then you did that for a while, but then there's another moment, and you're only touching briefly in your book about this, on this, but I didn't get this. You produced Mean Streets. You were in your mid-20s, and this is another huge turning point, isn't it? I mean, isn't this one of the films that started New Hollywood?
Yeah, I had produced the concert for Bangladesh for George Harrison. And I realized at the end of that, that most of the people that I was interested in working for in the music business were no longer touring. So, you know, Eric Clapton was having drug problems. George Harrison wasn't interested in going out on the road. Bob Dylan wasn't touring. The band was off the road. And so I just thought I'd go to California to see what I could find out about the movie business. And I had one name from a friend, and that was this kid named Marty Scorsese, who was a film editor who had edited part of the Woodstock movie, which the band had appeared in. And so I met him, and he showed me his short films and his student films, and I liked them. And I was just so naive. I didn't know you weren't supposed to invest your own money in movies. You were supposed to use other people's money, as the word is. But I went ahead and I got a friend and the money I'd made in the rock and roll business and some friends' money. And it was only $500,000, but it was a lot at the time. And we made Mean Streets. And fortunately, it turned out really well. You know, I mean, it could have been a complete disaster, but Marty had wanted to make the movie his whole life and kind of understood what he had to do, and he did it, and it was brilliant.
Yeah, and again, it changed everything, no? And I think the repercussions of that particular movie, I would say that you could still feel that in something like The Wire, which I think is the best thing that ever came to television.
I think that's true. I think there's a direct line from Mean Streets to things like The Wire. And I would call it a kind of neorealism. You know, that's a term that the Italians used about the films that were made in the late 40s, early 50s, like Bicycle Thief. You know, the sense of you weren't really sure whether it was a documentary or a fiction film, because the characters were so real and they were not people that you recognized as being stars. And so it was kind of unique in that sense. And it felt like it was incredibly real.
And again, the budget that you mentioned was very low budget for Hollywood at the time, right? And there was a moment when the studios lost control to the directors and the auteurs. And I think that was around about that time, correct?
Well, what had happened was the studio system was kind of falling apart. The big studios had invested in a series of musicals that were very expensive. You know, Hello, Dolly, you know, on the heels of a movie called Sound of Music, which had done very well. And then a lot of them made musicals, and they were all disasters. And, you know, and Fox had made a movie called Cleopatra, and they were just losing so much money that they were almost bankrupt. I mean, 20th Century Fox had to sell off its back lot just to keep the payroll going. And so the fact that these young kids out of film school could make a movie like Mean Streets or a movie like Badlands or a movie like American Graffiti for almost nothing was, you know, perfect for the studios, because they could pick up a movie and they didn't have to spend much money and they could release it. And so the timing was perfect because the studios were almost bankrupt and they could only afford to do these cheap, you know, independent movies. And so that started a whole new world of people like Francis Coppola and George Lucas and Marty Scorsese and so, you know, Brian De Palma and all these guys who came out of film school who knew how to make movies cheaply.
Right. Unfortunately, from today's point of view, that was just a phase because
yeah,
now it's all just big franchises and Marvel.
It didn't last that long because once Star Wars came in 79, so it lasted about a decade.
Yeah.
You know, but once Star Wars came in 79, then people realized you could make $100 million on a popcorn movie, then that's all they wanted to make.
Right. Did you produce movies throughout the 70s then, or did you go back on the road, or what did you do?
I did a movie called Under Fire with Nick Nolte and Gene Hackman. It was a very political movie about Nicaragua. And then I did The Last Waltz with Marty and the band, which was a documentary.
Was it your job to get all these people? I mean, come on, that guest list is just the most stellar.
Robbie Robertson was critical in getting musicians because they were all friends of the band. My job was to organize the production and to get it shot in one night over Thanksgiving in San Francisco. but that turned out really well. And then I wound up at Walt Disney in the early 80s as an independent producer. And Disney came under attack from a corporate raider. And I managed to help the management of Disney preserve the company's independence by getting some friends of mine from Texas, the Bass Brothers, to invest. And so I ended up getting paid by the Bass Brothers as their investment advisor. And I made so much money off that, made more money in 4 weeks than I'd made in 4 years. It was ridiculous. And so they asked me to be their investment banker. And I went to work on Wall Street for about 4.5 years.
In the 80s, in the decade of greed and
I mean, I did some interesting deals with Viacom and other companies, but I will be honest with you, I didn't really like it that much. It was a lot of money, but it was kind of soul killing. And so I quit after 4 years and went to work with Wim Wenders to make a movie called Until the End of the World.
Right.
And I came to Berlin in 1989 in February of 89.
Oh, a little too early because, eight months later, you would have been here for the wall.
We were there right after the wall came down. So we were actually in the Australian desert when the wall came down. But, you know, it's funny. We used to go in the summer of 89 from Kreuzberg, where we were living, over to Babelsberg Studios, which was in the east.
Right, near Potsdam, yeah.
Which was a very large soundstage where we were shooting some special effects shots. Mm-hmm. And we would go through Checkpoint Charlie every day. And then when we'd finish the work, there was a cafeteria in Babelsberg. And all the young film workers were there at the end of the day drinking a beer and watching MTV Europe on satellite. And I thought to myself at the time, man, they're already on the other side of the wall emotionally, right? We didn't know that the wall would fall. The strange thing in the plot, the movie, which was set in 1999, the wall comes down in 1999. Of course, it came down 10 years earlier. But anyway, that was a great experience.
Yeah. And how about Wim's extremely luxurious use of music in almost all of his movies? I think he values music like very few other, I think, auteurs of his kind. You know,
Wim is like Marty in the sense that they believe that music can drive the plot forward in a really interesting way, and not like a musical score, but rather the actual use of tunes. And like Marty, Vim had the ability to understand what was needed. And of course, I had the connections to the bands to get them to write to music words. But I mean, you know, quite honestly, Vim was the one who called Bono and said, can you write a theme song called Until the End of the World? And he did. That was a kind of connection that Vim had. And of course, the music was very critical to that movie.
Right. So let's move on. So then, when did you get involved with the sort of the culture of tech?
I saw a demonstration of a cable modem in 1995 at Cable Labs. And I understood that you could send video. It wasn't very good quality, but you could send video through a phone wire. Mm. And that's kind of was one of those aha moments, you know, where you thought, okay, well, then you could get what you want when you want it, wherever you want it. So in 96, I started a company called Entertainer, which was the first streaming video on demand service. And, you know, I got Comcast and NBC and then eventually Intel and Microsoft and a bunch of other companies to invest in it. And we built a pretty good product, and the video quality kept getting better and the bandwidth kept getting better, but it was probably a little too early. You know, broadband had not gotten that diffused. And then
we're talking mid-90s here?
Mid-90s.
Yeah, that's a bit early.
Into early 2000.
Right.
And in 2001, one of the shareholders of Entertainer, which was Sony, went behind our backs and basically built an exact replica of what we had built. And they called it MovieLink. And they went and they made a deal with all the other majors for exclusive rights for streaming video. And all of a sudden, we had no product. And so we had to shut down. We went from having like 8,000 movies on the service to having 8. And so we shut down the service. And I sued all the major studios in antitrust court. And needless to say, I couldn't go back to being a movie producer since I was suing them all.
Oh, my.
So I went to become an academic. I was hired by the University of Southern California, the Annenberg School for Communications, to be a professor. And then a few years later, I won the lawsuit so I could afford to be a professor. And then a couple of years after that, I started the Annenberg Innovation Lab. And ironically, a bunch of the companies that I had been suing became investors in the Innovation Lab.
Yeah.
So right. What goes around comes around.
Okay. So then you wrote a book, which I've been trying to find and I couldn't. You know, when I was finished with this book, which we're going to talk about in a second, I saw, well, there's another book, Outlaw Blues, Adventures in the Counterculture Wars. And I was looking at it for it, and then I realized it's an iPad book or something like that.
It's actually going to get reissued next week.
Oh, next week. Well, that's timely.
On the Apple bookstore.
But what I did find about it was that a lot of people who read it and bought it were complaining about the fact that you were sort of dragging them back into the Apple ecosystem. And if you want to, it's an interactive book, I suppose, and you can watch video or download music or, but you always have to sort of pay money to Apple, and people were complaining about that.
Right.
I was wondering about that. What, was that the idea?
No, the idea was to try and make a book in which you integrated video and text.
Right. Which is modern, but it was only working in the sort of inside the Apple ecosystem, correct?
Yeah.
All right.
Because Amazon wouldn't support the video.
Right.
So only Apple had the system to do that. And so you could, you know, it's one thing to talk about Jimi Hendrix at Monterey in 1987, But to see him light his guitar on fire, that was pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's what it does. Instead of having pictures, you can actually watch 30 seconds of the performance.
Right. Did you go to Monterey? Were you there?
Yeah.
Oh. Anyways, so Move Fast and Break Things. And the subtitle is How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Maybe we'll begin with the title of the book. These Silicon Valley companies, they've always worked under this rebellious guise, this cool factor, the whole folklore. We are disruptive, creative hackers. We're practically hackers. We're bringing innovation and solutions. What happened to all that?
Well, the original theory of the internet, when Tim Berners-Lee and John Seely Brown and Vint Cerf, the people that really invented the internet in the late 60s, the idea was that the internet was there to create a decentralized media platform. Because in the late 60s, at least in America, there were three TV networks and one newspaper in any given city, and that was the media. So the idea of a completely decentralized platform was great. But what happened was that in the late 80s, a group of libertarian thinkers, including Jeff Bezos, Peter Thiel, Larry Page, really understood that the internet was going to be a winner-takes-all business, that the notion of the scale of economics of what we call the network effect meant that there would be really one winner in search and search advertising, or there would be one dominant e-commerce player, or there would be one dominant, eventually, social network.
Excuse me one second if I interrupt. Do you think they had this realization back in the late 80s?
Yeah. I mean, Thiel talks about it. He said that, the things that you need, if you're going to achieve this, you have to have the ability to, A, have no regulation, that the internet should not have any taxes on it. So, Amazon was able to sell books without paying any sales taxes and put in America 4,000 independent bookstores out of business. You would have no copyright restrictions. So YouTube is built on the notion that nobody can get their content off of YouTube. I mean, you can file a takedown notice, but it'll go right back up again. And ultimately, no competition. As Peter Thiel says, competition is for losers, so that really you would build these perfect monopolies. And that's essentially what they did. I mean, 10 years ago, the largest companies in the world were ExxonMobil, General Electric, Citibank, companies like that. And today, the largest companies in the world are Apple, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Microsoft. So, these companies operate at scale. I don't think that Apple is a monopoly, and I don't think Microsoft is a monopoly, but I certainly think that Google has a monopoly on search and search advertising. I think that Amazon has a monopoly on the book business and is going to increasingly try and find monopoly points in other businesses. And I think that Facebook and the companies it owns, like Instagram and WhatsApp, are the dominant monopoly social network.
So they've built monopolies that we all serve knowing or unknowingly. But do you think there's a date where this all changed, where the internet that we all thought was going to make everything a lot more democratic, everything's going to be more,
right,
level playing field? Where would you set that date when that utopia ended?
Google went public in 2003, raised billions of dollars. At that point, it had about 30% market share in search. Within 10 years, it had 90% market share. So I would say that that's probably the date you think about. I mean, if you wanted to set it, I mean, I think that people basically, and certainly the investor community, saw what was happening. I mean, you in Europe, you call it FANG, or, you know, the acronym for Facebook, Amazon, you know, Google and Apple. You know, I mean, these companies are winner takes all companies. And until the regulators crack down on them from an antitrust point of view, they will continue to be winner takes all companies.
Right. I mean, monopolies can't, everybody knows kind of, okay, the, you know, monopolies are not good. I think even in the 90s, people were afraid of Windows or Microsoft getting a monopoly on the sort of user interface.
Right. Right.
So,
I mean, but the government sued Microsoft because Microsoft wanted you to have to use its own browser, Internet Explorer, if you use Windows.
Right.
So, needless to say, there would have never been a Google if Microsoft had been able to force you to use Internet Explorer. So, I think, you know, the history of antitrust is actually a history of innovation. I make the argument that Silicon Valley would never have existed if there hadn't been an antitrust case in the 1950s where the government sued AT&T, which was the monopoly phone company in the United States at the time, and forced its research and development facility, Bell Labs, to license every patent that it had for free to any American company or individual who wanted them. And it just so happened that Bell Labs had the patent for the transistor, the laser, the satellite, the cellular system, all the basic foundational patents of the digital age had come out of Bell Labs. And so that alone created new companies like Hewlett-Packard, Motorola, Texas Instruments, Fairchild Semiconductor, Intel, all these companies came out of those free patents. So, you know, and then 20 years later, the government sued IBM because IBM wanted you to have to buy their software when you bought their hardware. And of course, that then, over after a 13-year lawsuit, made it possible for when IBM made the personal computer to let somebody else make the software, i.e. two kids from Seattle named Bill Gates and Paul Allen, and that created Microsoft. So, I mean, the history of progress is the history of antitrust.
Right. So we should be scared.
No, we should institute antitrust suits because that will lead to progress.
The EU is on it.
The EU is the leader. EU is the total leader.
But the lobbying efforts of these of the Silicon Valley, they're quite aggressive.
No, they're spending a lot of money in Brussels.
And in Washington.
Oh, they spend huge amounts of money in Washington. More than any, Google spends more money than any company in America on lobbying. And now they probably spend more money than any company in the world in Brussels on lobbying.
They kind of operate programs to harness the brain power of university researchers and to try and sway opinion and public policy towards their interest and goals, which is, of course, for instance, copyright. Copyright is one thing that stands in the way of search because if there's a barrier, you can't search it. If you can't search and find it, you can't advertise it. So I suppose copyright which I reckon is the labor law of the creative people, is badly in the way of everything Google wants, correct?
Google hates copyright.
Right. So
They spend $3 to $4 million a year paying academics to write papers supporting their view of the world. And some of that is about copyright.
Right. And they're breeding a new breed of professors and academics and PhDs and whatnot that will gladly sing their song.
Totally.
How do we counter this?
Well, I mean, partially it's public awareness. You know, I think quite frankly, from the time My book came out 6 months ago to today. You've seen a radical reevaluation of just the role that big tech plays in the world. 6 months ago, you know, the idea that Google might be, that Google's motto of don't be evil was totally true is now looked at as a joke. You know, in other words, people now understand that these companies are not just perfect ideas of innovation and commerce. And, you know, the fact that, needless to say, the U.S. elections and the Brexit vote, all that were deeply influenced by propaganda put forth on these platforms. The fact that you have no privacy anymore is something that people are worried about. The fact that young people are totally addicted to their smartphones and spend, you know, 2 hours a day on Facebook. All these things are becoming more aware. The fact that, you know, journalist organizations have lost 50% of their employment and 75% of their revenues since Google arrived. I mean, many, many problems are now being aired that concern these platforms, and these platforms are on the defense, and that's only going to continue. You know, in other words, I think at least in the United States, we're going to have an election in 2020, which will be basically a decision. Do we want to continue down this libertarian path, which Donald Trump and Paul Ryan and the people who run the current government are determined to do, which is more deregulation, make it easier for monopolies, more inequality, more corruption, or do we want to change direction? And I think the American people are going to have to make a decision about that. And of course, Trump ran a campaign in 2016 as if he was a populist, as if he wanted to overthrow the bankers and you know, get rid of all this corruption. And but once he got into office, he's totally running as a billionaire, you know, a Koch brothers stooge. And so, you know, this tax cut that he just passed, you know, 90% of the benefit goes to the top 1%. So, I mean, whether he can continue to fool the working class in America using kind of cultural tropes like, you know, oh, the homosexuals are taking over the world or, you know, whatever the hell he's, or the immigrants are coming for your job or, you know, whatever his method was in exciting, you know, kind of working class people to think that that Trump is their guy. I'm not positive he can continue to do that. And so, you know, but that's the question, because quite frankly, you know, Peter Thiel made it very clear that democracy and capitalism are not compatible anymore, that democracy is constantly getting in the way of capitalism. And so what is needed from their point of view is a lot less democracy. And that means voter suppression, distract people. So in the U.S., you know, 50% of the people who could vote don't even bother to vote. And you know, they're not rich people. So, I mean, you know, there are a lot of techniques that are being employed. And of course, the ability to use the brilliant targeting tactics of Facebook and take a firm like Cambridge Analytica and, you know, make very specific ads tailored to your very specific anxieties and get you to vote for Trump and think that Hillary Clinton is a crook is new. You know, these are all new things. And so we're going to have to figure out how to deal with that. Mm-hmm. I think that the 2020 election will be the critical moment. Either we're going to become a much more richer democracy, or we're going to go and we're just going to give up and it becomes a plutocracy run for the benefit of the Koch brothers and the Mercer family. I mean, look, my sense is that the tools that the people who built Facebook or the Google search algorithm, they don't really even understand what they did. A few months ago, Sheryl Sandberg was the COO. Facebook said that she was totally shocked when she found out that people were using their advertising algorithm targeting tools to target anti-Semitic users Well, how naive could she be? I mean, she's out there advertising that you can reach women in Nashville, Tennessee, who drive trucks and drink bourbon. And she said, thinks you can't target the anti-Semitic voters. I mean, give me a break.
She can't be serious about this.
Well, she said it. Right. Look, you're right. She's probably, she doesn't really believe it, but at least that's their line.
But that's the same kind of thing that when, you know, what you're also talking about in your book, for instance, where YouTube are very good at blocking pornography on their site, on their channels or where on YouTube. You don't find any sort of pornography there, but you find everything else, everything that is copyrighted, everything. So do they play naive? Do they just go, oh, sorry, we don't know how
to. In the U.S., they are protected by a very specific law called the Safe Harbor.
I know.
And it was a big mistake. It wasn't meant to protect Google. It was meant to protect an ISP like AT&T, which clearly...
A provider of internet services, right.
It provides a wire and has no idea or no ability to monitor everything that flows over its wire. But Google is actually making choices as to what goes on YouTube and what does not go on YouTube. Makes those choices every day. It just wants every piece of music that exists in the whole world there because that's what a lot of people want. They want free music. And so, you know, you can sue to have your tune taken off of YouTube, but the next day it'll go right back up.
There's a chapter in your book where you, and I feel... You're just hinting at something that I just thought is the scariest bit because you're talking about what's going on in China.
Right.
Can you elaborate a bit? Can you tell us? That sounded like some real Orwellian shit.
So, I mean, the thing that scares me the most right now is a service called Sesame Social Credit. And what it is, it's built by a company called Alibaba. And essentially what it does is it takes your credit score, that is how well you repay your credit cards, how timely you are. And then it overlays on top of that a artificial intelligence derived social media score, which is, for instance, if Christoph, you played video games for 7 hours on Saturday, your social credit would go down because you would be considered a slacker. If I wrote something on WeChat that was critical of the Chinese government, my social credit score would be going down because I would be considered unpatriotic. If you happened to cross a street in the middle of the block in Shanghai, you were jaywalking, and one of those ubiquitous facial recognition cameras that are everywhere in Shanghai caught you on it, your social credit score would go down because you'd be considered a lawbreaker. Now, you'd think, why would anybody want to be on that service? Well, there's 200 million Chinese on that service. And what's most shocking to me is that the young millennials put their social credit score on their dating apps to prove how patriotic they are. Now, it could be that because the ratio of young men to young women in China is really skewed, there's like 4 men to every woman, that maybe being patriotic and seeing as you have a long-term future as a patriotic Chinese citizen is probably helpful in dating apps. But it does seem to me kind of screwy, you know, and the funny thing was that Xi Jinping at the party Congress suggests that everybody in China should be on Sesame Social Credit.
Wow. That's full on Orwell.
Yeah, it's totally Orwell. And it's voluntary, too.
So, okay, well, when's your book going to come out in Germany?
I would die to have my book come out in Germany. And I have not had any publisher approach me. Well, look, I mean, it's funny because I'm going to Copenhagen at the end of January and then to Amsterdam to give talks. So, I mean, you know, the book is out in Denmark and Sweden and England and Netherlands and lots of other places. And so I'm giving talks and certainly there is a very big awareness. It's just, you know, weird to me that Germany, which has been so good on these issues on confronting Google, is nobody seemed to be interested in publishing it. Right. But maybe change that.
Yeah, we'll have to work on that.
Great. Okay,
well, I'll let you go. Thanks so much,
Thanks
Jonathan.
So much. It's a great interview.
Yeah, and good luck. Safe travels.
Great.
Thank
bye.
You. All right, bye-bye. Oh, great. Just great. The Newport Folk Festival, of course. That's where Dylan first went electric. But the band only joined him for the famous world tour of 65 and 66, and then some. So he had to remind me of that. But hey, still was a good talk, I thought. Interesting guy. And what a life. And what a great book to boot. I can, again, only recommend it again and again. Move Fast and Break Things. Jonathan Taplin is the author. It's some scary stuff, isn't it? But okay, that was that. Spill the Wine will return. No message from any sponsors this week. We are alone, you and me. So, over and out. Look after yourself. Be good.